Coexition number 11512, Reel 2.
Major Watson, Reel 2.
I joined the 7th Battalion Black Watch in the Shetlands, as it happened, and that was the battalion in which my father and my uncle had served with in the First World War. Purely coincidental, but a thing of great joy to me. The CO of the 7th Battalion at that time, who gloried under the name of Hamphonius Daniel, Colonel Robertson, had been a second lieutenant in the 7th Battalion at the end of the First World War, and of course knew my father well. We ultimately left Shetlands, went down to Tain, where we were coastal defence for a while in the north of Scotland. Then we went to Aldershot to be sent out to the desert. We left Aldershot, and this was my second visit to Aldershot, as I recall now, having been there in 1939. We left Aldershot, I suppose it must have been April 1942, went via South Africa on a ship called the Strathiden, stopped at Durban for two or three very pleasant days, and ultimately landed in Port Said at the head of the Red Sea. And by Jove, was it hot and sticky and muggy in the Red Sea. It was absolutely incredible. Perhaps one should say that on the way down through the off the coast of West Africa through the South Atlantic, we had our first submarine scare. We were being escorted by, oh dear, can I remember the name of the battleship? Ah yes, the Malay, or the Malaya battleship, and some destroyers, the convoy in which we were. I don't quite remember what we thought of the submarine scare, but there must have been several on the way down. How we knew about them, goodness alone knows, but then word does get around between men and on ships, even if you cannot see the danger or the threat that is apparently in the area. Well, having arrived at Suez, we got off the ship. Perhaps one should say here that great care was taken on the way down on the Strathiden, A, to inculcate us fully if we required it, with a sense of pride in our units and a sense of pride of being members of the 51st Highland Division. This was the inspiration not only of our commanding officers, but also of General Douglas Wimberley, or Tartan Tam, as he was known with great affection by us all, who was a Cameroonian who then commanded the 51st Highland Division. We were also made to wear our boots a large part of the day, and not just plimsolls, because the message apparently had been learned that when A Division, which was sent out to Singapore, after a long sea journey, having been in plimsolls most of the time, found that they couldn't get easily used to the use of their ammunition boots again, incurred all kinds of feet trouble when they were marching, and therefore were less adequate fighting forces than they might otherwise have been. This in part is hearsay, but does have the ring of truth about it. Anyhow, we stepped ashore fully fit, but bloody hot, exhausted in this very, very humid heat, and eventually we went to a place, as I recall, called Katatba, which was on the fringe of the desert proper. In other words, we had gone through the cultivated Nile area to the west, where the real desert was. We spent some time there getting used to desert conditions. We went to route marches every morning with steel hats on, small packs, boots, etc., etc., to get inoculated to the heat and marching on sand, and just get generally used to the strains and stresses that the body would have to undergo living under, to us, somewhat foreign climatic conditions. We had at one stage been given topis. Why? I don't think anyone knows, but anyhow, they were hurriedly at one stage withdrawn, I seem to remember, and we wore our tam o' shanters, our in battle steel helmets. We then went to Kassassin, I think, and again we went through various forms of battle indoctrination and drills and things of that nature.
Where's Kassassin?
It's also on the in the desert fringe in the in Egypt. If I may digress slightly here, recently on business, I decided that I would go to the war memorial, Alamein, never having been there. So I got this Egyptian with a car. We went from Cairo to Alexandria on the desert road. The area to our left, the west, was a Egyptian military area, so one couldn't go into the desert, or the Maidan, as we called it there. But I suddenly saw, in the distance, some huts, very large huts, which looked slightly familiar. And I could just discern, on the front of one of them, the letters had been taken away, but the shadow, N-A-A-F-I. And this was obviously one of the old Nafi buildings that were in the various camps in which we were before we went into the front line at Alamein. We liaised to a great extent with the Australians to get battle experience. I think it was the 1st 17th Battalion, and they were quite outstanding, and I hope I've got the number right. They were so at ease under conditions which were certainly very foreign to us, very hardened people, remarkable fighters, and having read accounts later on of their exploits and seen them, of course, at first hand ourselves afterwards, an astonishing bunch of soldiers, no question. We had the same experience with the New Zealanders, who were also impressive. I suppose only we who were there, without making too personal a point of it, could appreciate what the Eighth Army owes to the fighting of the Australians and the New Zealanders and our own British units who had been there during 1940 and 1941.
Did the Australians look down on British troops?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think they perhaps tended to look at us rather in a kind of avuncular way. They knew they were good. We as a kind of new division, the 51st in the desert, we hoped going to be good, but we had to learn the skills of the trade of desert fighting, in which they and the New Zealanders were undoubtedly past masters. No, I don't think so. I think they may have felt they knew a great deal more than us, but I don't think they would ever look down on us. Certainly I was never conscious of that or anything of a similar nature. It was an experience which can't really be judged or easily talked about, I think, to be to go into the front line of the Alamein line for the first time, because when one talks of front lines, one tends to think of a line, of sheds of the First World War, trenches and dugouts and things of that nature, a kind of clearly defined spot on the face of the earth. The desert is a vast, rolling area of basically of flatness with few distinguishing marks, and under a glaring hot sun, distances are sometimes difficult to comprehend. So when you went into the line at Alamein, apart from, and this is subsequent reading, the feature of Tel Eliza Hill on the right, there were no great distinguishing features. You were just in duvers or holes in the ground, not a continuous trench line, facing to the west with your own barbed wire in front of you, and then some distance away the German barbed wire in no man's land. But we stayed with them not as a battalion, the sisters that we're talking about, the 7th Battalion Black Watch now, but groups of us, officers and jocks, went up to be given patrol duties with them, go out on patrol with the Australians, and just get the general feel of what we were there to do.
Was there a feeling of anticipation at this time that something big was going to be launched?
Well, there was certainly something big happening as we were there, and I say that in the sense that it was a big event for us to be in the desert, which was the only successful military area on land that Britain had been involved in. I suppose, and this again is thinking back, we must have realized that something was about to happen, because the story of the desert warfare was swings and roundabouts, and the ball, as it were, was in the Allies' court, in that Rommel and the Afrika Korps had pushed us close to Alexandria, because I think the distance is only about 20, 25 miles, Alex to Alamein, and we certainly weren't going to cede Egypt, so we would have to fight and chase the Germans and Italians back from the Alamein position. Undoubtedly, as time went on and we began to get accustomed to desert conditions and involved in various exercises, we did appreciate that the whole point of these exercises was against the time when we would be used in an attack on the German lines. There's so much in one's mind about this particular period that I must avoid the tendency to wander a bit, but on one occasion, the principal defences at Alamein was organised in boxes, and a box was a heavily defended local position. If there were some slight high ground, it would be on that. Otherwise, it would be in the flat of the desert. And I don't know how many there were, but I think as a division, we were in three or four different boxes, surrounded by barbed wire, with mines outside the barbed wire. And inside the box, in our holes in the ground, the infantry with various units of artillery, etc., so that if the Germans did try to break through the Alamein line, these locally defended positions would be able to hold out and to go against the rear of his attacking columns if he did so attack. They were, in a way, one felt in them that they were slightly inhibitive of movement. In other words, your life was spent in that box. And I remember one time I got sandfly fever, so-called. I don't know what it is, but I was apparently terribly sick in that I was comatose, sweating, unable to do anything for 2 or 3 days. Eventually recovered under the tender care of the doc and my own resilience. But I remember being so pleased that at least I wasn't sent back to hospital.
Did Montgomery come round? Did you see him before the battle?
Yes. Monty came, I don't know how long before the Battle of Alamein, to visit all his troops. He was constantly going to visit units of the 8th Army. And he was a most inspiring little man. Because when we got there, I suppose Monty arrived shortly thereafter or had arrived before, but there had been a feeling apparently in the 8th Army that they were, as it were, in defence and almost in retreat, that perhaps to a degree they, and here one has to be careful because so many historians who weren't even there have had their say on it, but that to a degree we had almost reached the end of our tether and we were hanging on to our fairly desperate position. And I believe it's true to say, although this is again hearsay because I was a mere infantry officer, that there were, or there must have been, various contingency plans in the headquarters in Cairo that if the worst did happen and the Germans were able to break through the Alamein line and into Egypt, what the disposition would then be of what remaining troops there were, with a view to keeping the Germans out of what was then Palestine and out of getting access to India. But this is all rather highfalutin stuff, but if there were such plans and if there was this feeling of apprehension then, when Monty came, and it cannot be ascribed to him alone, but when he came, the whole tenor of thinking was one of, I suppose, offence and not defence. Almost, who the hell do these krauts think they are? I mean, we're here and we're going to, as he ultimately said, knock the Germans out of Africa for six. It is astonishing, well, like Carlyle, the hero as prophet, the hero as soldier, how the attitude of one man can so affect and inspire the attitudes of others, because his presence, what he said, how he said it, had a, although one might have been smiling up one's sleeve on occasions, had a remarkably stimulating and confidence-building effect on anybody who kind of heard him or saw him. Much has been said about the fact that, oh yes, Monty had all the means and material of war to carry out the job, but of course, A, he insisted on having it or he wouldn't do the job, and B, if one looks at his military life, he had the confidence of knowing that, given the troops, he would do what was required of him. So I think it's a lot of bunkum to say that others could have done it as well as Montgomery.
Do you remember a specific visit of his to your formation?
I think I would have to refer to our battalion history for that, but I just remember being lined up and Monty saying, as he usually did from the back of a truck, right, gather round, and everyone broke ranks, and he came and told us that he and we were there to drive the Germans out of Africa. The main thoughts that one has as one gets perhaps closer to the 23rd of October, when the Battle of El Alamein started, or the main remembrances, are of the vast exercises in which we had to take place behind the line, a rehearsal, although we knew it not, for the Battle of Alamein. I think we did three different rehearsals for the Battle of Alamein. We did the taping of the start line. We did the slow advance to the enemy positions. We had live ammunition being fired by our artillery overhead. We had practice of all the formations of fighting under desert conditions, so that when the time of Alamein did come, we were well rehearsed in what we were expected to do. What one also recalls is are the steps taken to deceive the Germans as to the number of British troops there were and where any attack was going to take place. There were a large numbers of dummy vehicles and tanks made out of cardboard and Hessian in the southern part of the Alamein line, to the extent that I suppose from the air there could be a slight dominance of material of war in the south rather than in the north. Just prior to the battle, we ourselves had to move. Now, how did it go? Yes, we moved down to the south by day to give the impression of a build-up of troops south of the in the southern part of the Alamein line, and we moved back by night to the Alamein position, when of course observation could not be made by aircraft of the movement of troops. And as I recall, we did that on two occasions to again give the impression of weight of numbers in the south and fewer troops in the north. My own particular part in the operation, I was then IO, intelligence officer, in the 7th Battalion, and it was my responsibility to ensure that the rate of advance, once the battle started, was commensurate with the movement of our artillery barrage. And to that end, I had to train my I section, intelligence section, and practice myself the speed at which we would move over a certain distance of ground, and that speed would then be altered after several minutes to a different speed, because we would then be moving closer behind our own artillery barrage. And it was all done with a view to the infantry and the artillery coordinating their movement, so that the artillery barrage was reasonably close to the infantry without in fact falling amongst our own infantry. It was also my job to keep direction, because there being no landmarks, but in any case the battle was to start at night, the whole battle had to be fought on, the whole advance had to be done on a compass bearing, for which of course we used prismatic compasses. I also had the task of making a sand model and showing the dispositions of our own troops and of the enemy, and the lines of advance which we had to follow, and the troops that were on our right and left. On our left, I'm proud to say, were the New Zealand Division, and on our right, equally proud to say, were the Australian Division.
Before we actually go into the Battle of Alamein, can you tell me if there were any accidents in the training that you did, in the rehearsals?
The rehearsals were pretty hot stuff. Remarkable organisation and a vast number of troops and guns employed, and Royal Engineers, including in the troops, sweeping the mines. Yes, I remember, I think it was Ian Lyle. I think he was C Company on the left front of the battalion advance in the rehearsal. I think one of our artillery shells fell short, and I think it was Ian who copped it then. Ian was of the famous sugar company, Tate and Lyle, a very old Scottish family, a delightful fellow, quite delightful. Talking of the rehearsals, well, perhaps I can go back a little bit when I'm talking about navigation in the desert. I was appointed as an intelligence officer, which meant I was attached to battalion headquarters directly under the command, as it were, of the commanding officer of the battalion, Colonel James Oliver. And one of my tasks, apart from trying to be intelligent, was to be navigating officer for the battalion. And I shall never forget a desert exercise in which we took, when we were using not the prismatic compass, but the coal sun compass, which basically was a kind of needle sticking up from the middle of a degree chart, a circular degree chart, which was fixed onto the vehicle. And you told the, you worked out the direction in which you wanted to go from the map in so many degrees, and then you so positioned the vehicle that the sun cast the shadow of this needle over that degree position on the circular chart. And came the day when Watson was really going to be tested, and felt it, and this was a desert navigational exercise, the whole battalion. And there I was stuck out in front, and we were to do a triangular leg, start at point A, go to point B, then point C, and then back to point A. Set off, I forget how many miles the legs were, maybe 4, 5, or 6, I don't know. We got to, from A we got to B, and this is a completely featureless landscape, and all you're doing now is you're working off the map, and you've gone so many miles in a certain degree